Here we go.
The Senate Judiciary Committee will come back to order. We're going to take Senate file.
House file.
House file 334. Senator
Scheid? Madam Chair, yes. It's the companion to Senate file 683.
Which is the companion to Senate file 683.
Mm-hmm. And, Madam Chair, there is a delete everything amendment. Do we have literally the House file but Senate language in front of us? Or, mm-hmm.
Well,
or do we have House language?
House file's here.
We have the House file, House language, but we have your delete everything amendment.
And, Madam Chair, and perhaps Ms. Pontius will share with you what it meant. We're effectively adopting what the House did with this bill. Concerns garnishment, but there were things left out, and there's a lot of forms that needed to be included. And I think that the revisor's office has trouble with sometimes putting, we don't do it very often. Maybe we don't do it very often because it's tricky getting all the forms in. But Ms. Pontius has labored with this, well, I don't know if it was the better part of a week, but I know.
Senator Scheid, would you rather we have Ms. Pontius walk us through the A6 amendment?
Well, let's have somebody knows what's going on.
Well, Madam Chair, I just wanted to tell you, you know, what it does.
Mm-hmm.
There are several forms of garnishment, and this deals with those. There's the sheriff's levy, and there is the attorney summary execution, and there is the financial institution or bank garnishment. And Section 1 is the sheriff's levy, and you're going to see language repeated then. That's Section 1. Attorney summary execution is Section 3. You're going to see similar language and forms there. And in Section 6 through 9, that's the bank garnishment process. And again, and I think that was what was inadvertently left out of the House bill. So then there's Section 4, which is an important piece. There have been groups, more than one group, working on the issue of garnishment, and they have, I don't know how long you've been working together, but for a couple of years, and have come to some agreement. And so prejudgment garnishment actually is Section 4, and then the forms are included in Section 5 for the prejudgment garnishment. And I suppose, well, it's very important here. I think the forms really improve notification to consumers, to debtors. In fact, one of my favorite lines, I mean, I think it's important, actually, that explains that the creditor, the person to whom you owe money is the creditor, you are the debtor. That's helpful, I think, for a lot of people. And there's bold typeface, and I think it's much more readable for people to know, you know, what's happening to them, what garnishment means to them, and particularly the prejudgment garnishment, which I think has had some controversy about it. But this, if you look at Section 4, actually requires now, there's two levels of notice. There's first notice is the summons and complaint, and I think that's explanatory language as well. And then if the person doesn't respond, and I think current law is 40 days, but this would be 45 days. We've added 40, 5 days on there. If there's no response from the debtor, then on day 21, if you don't have a response, you get the second notice. So actually, I kind of did that. I said the 45-day thing first. I shouldn't have. On day 21, if there's no response, the person gets a second notice. And then if there's no response, in 45 days, they can go ahead with the garnishment. And there's also, I think, very good explanatory language about what kind of income or asset offers you an exemption against being garnished. And that is important language here, too. I don't know what I've left out. I'm sure I've left out something, but I know we did some updating of the exemption terms, and there probably needs to be. That's something that we should probably do more continuously because some of those terms change from time to time. So I would ask Ms. Strong or Mr.
Elwood.
Elwood.
Yes, Elwood.
It's hard to forget me. I'm here all the time.
Who's that guy?
No, you don't. I know it's Elwood. Mr. Elwood, to give you more definitive.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, Mr. Elwood, I just want to be clear when you start. Are we only changing the forms, or are there substantive changes in the garnishment law or the procedures and how it's done? I just, as you're going through it, I would like to know that.
That's Senator Scheid. That's a good point, Madam Chair. And there, I mean, I would say there's some substance because of adding the second notice on the prejudgment garnishment and also extending the time frame before which the garnishment can take place. But I will let Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Elwood.
Expand on that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood, Legal Aid. And before I answer, I just want to thank you all for your indulgence this session. I'm sure I've long since worn out my welcome before this committee, but I do appreciate all the work that you've done on the bills that we brought before you, so thank you very much. The other principal substantive change that this bill does is to change the process with respect to when a bank sends obtains the garnishment from the creditor, sending the exemption notice form to the debtor. Under current law, the debtor would send the exemption form back to the bank, which in turn sends it to the creditor. The creditor can now object to the exemption assertion. Then the burden shifts back to the debtor to request a hearing. What this bill does is cut out one step in that process. It streamlines the process. The bank will send the exemption form to the debtor. The debtor sends it back. When the creditor receives it, if the creditor has some reason to believe that there's the exemption assertion is inaccurate, it will become now, after if and when you pass this bill, that the creditor would now have the responsibility to request the hearing.
Ms. Elwood, if the creditor is the one that's objecting to the exemptions, how does that resolve the exemption in the instance of the debtor?
Madam Chair and members, if the creditor objects, then the creditor would be the party responsible now under this new format, new structure.
Simultaneously asking for a hearing.
For a hearing, exactly.
Anything else that is substantive in language, Ms. Strong?
Madam Chair, Sarah Strong, representing the Minnesota Bankers Association and the Minnesota Association of Collectors. One thing that you'll want to note is we are now going to ask debtors to submit 60 days of their most recent bank statements along with their exemption claims. And the reason for this is the bank statements are the easiest, simplest, best way to prove an exemption. And right now, there's creditors who often have very difficult times getting evidence from a debtor of their exemption. And so an exemption form may be submitted with no proof whatsoever, and that's what often sends it to a hearing. If it does go to a hearing, the judge asks the debtor for bank statements, which they then give to the creditor. So this is another instance of trying to cut out an extra step in the process and hopefully avoid going to a court hearing.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Elwood. I don't know anything about this area of law, but I was just wondering, as I was reading through this, how does that work when, you know, say a person puts some money into their bank account that falls under one of these exemptions, but then they go along and they spend money and they put money in and take money out, and a couple months later, I mean, is there some kind of a rule, like first in, first out, or, you know, how do you determine what do those bank statements do to make that, to help with that when you don't really know which money is being spent for a purpose?
Mr. Elwood?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, it is a first in, first out, and that's part of the reason why the bank statements are so critical, because you can tell by the when the deposits were made, when the withdrawals were made. It's obviously not perfect, but it's a good indication of which money is in the bank at the time the garnishment is accomplished.
Any other substantive change in the bill?
Just
Madam Chair, I don't think so.
Senator Betzel.
Senator Scheid, Mr. Elwood, I just wanted, I'm looking at page 30, and I'm trying to make sure I've got all the timelines in my head right. Starting page 30, line 20, if the creditor sends a notice of intent to garnish to a debtor, the creditor cannot obtain a default judgment until 25 days after the service of the notice of intent. I'm just trying to figure out how the timeline's in and, you know, why it's structured this way. Could you just remind me of how what comes first and why we have that language there?
Ms. Elwood?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, the process starts with the service of a summons and complaint to the debtor. The debtor then, as with all summons, has 20 days to answer. Under current Minnesota law, there is no second notice after the initial summons and complaint. Right. And under current law, after 40 days, if there's no response, the money can be seized. We have identified several problems with that process. First of all, because it's prejudgment garnishment state, many times debtors will call the court and say, when's my hearing? And since, of course, there's no filing, no filed case, there's no hearing, they don't respond. Or a debtor may actually pick up the phone and call somebody and talk to somebody, but that's not a formal answer. So what occurs here is the 40 days has been increased to 45 days, the 5 days being the time to mail the second notice after the initial 20 days has expired. And the second notice is very plain. It says you didn't answer, and here's what you got to do. Either tell us you have exempt funds, tell us it's not your debt. If it is your debt, call us up, try to make an arrangement to pay. It's extremely plain language, and we're very, very hopeful this will resolve a lot of problems that this current system engenders.
So Madam Chair,
Betzel.
You'd still have to get the default judgment from the court before you can actually complete the garnishment or not?
Mr. Elwood?
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, actually, under this system, there really is not a requirement to get a judgment.
Okay.
Any further discussion? Senator Betzel.
I was just, because it says it can, the creditor cannot obtain a default judgment until after 25 days. That doesn't say the creditor cannot get a default judgment. It just, you have to have a waiting time period, and you don't even need one, apparently.
Any further discussions on the A6 amendment?
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Just an observation. If I remember correctly, I think in the early 1980s, I think a lot of changes were made in this area of the law as well, too. And the trouble is, I think for like almost every legislative session for another year or two after that, they went back and made some changes and revisions, which in this day of word processing, when you can just generate the forms on your computer, it makes it a little easier to do. But I would hope that we just let it sit out there for a while and not have to come back and cause some confusion in this area of the law, which sometimes happens when we make too many changes in a short period of time.
Right. Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair.
I noticed a $1 fee in here, $1 filing fee to the courts. Can you talk a little bit about that, and does that $1...
Strong, Ken.
Yeah, page 11, line 26.
What page are you using?
1126. 11?
Thank you.
26.
It's in a couple of places. So the first, page 11, line 26. Ms. Strong?
Madam Chair, members, because we're combining the notice of objection and notice of hearing, we're deleting some other language. And so, for the instance, the first instance, the one on 1126, if you look over on page 12, lines 30 through 32, we're deleting pretty much similar language. And so we're keeping the same dollar fee that you have in law. So we're not, the intent of this is to not change any fees whatsoever.
So it's not creating a new fee, it's just the same fee shifted over.
Mm-hmm. Correct, Madam Chair.
To a different place. All right.
And Madam Chair, it appears
Senator Betzel?
That page 25, line 35 right. is the new language, and it's deleted page 27, line 5.
Okay.
So.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. Any further discussions on the A6 amendment? Senator Scheid moves the A6 amendment. Anybody here want to be heard on the A6 amendment? See none. All those in favor of the A6 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, may I just say that we are so lucky, we are so well served by council, and I really appreciate what Ms. Pontius did to make this be right. And so I think we can feel good that it's been done thoroughly. Not we, but you know, she was able to catch all of those references. I believe they're all caught. So, I'd
Ms.
like
Pontius,
to move.
Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. I have to give the most credit to Carolee Stock, who's my secretary,
yes.
who had to deal with all these forms in the revisor system, and they're not very user friendly for that. So.
No.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel?
Senator Scheid, can we make sure that the other body accepts the Senate language so we don't have to go to conference committee over this?
I think you wouldn't want to be appointed to that conference
committee. I don't want to be on it.
And Madam Chair, I think they are going to be greatly relieved when they see it in its proper form. Yes.
I may have to vote against the bill on the floor just to avoid being in the conference committee.
That doesn't stop me from getting on.
Yeah, I know. Well, yeah.
Senator Scheid, what's your desire with House File 334?
Well, Madam Chair, I'd like to move that House File 334 is amended be recommended to pass.
And be referred to the Senate floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Ortman? Senator Ortman, Senate File 1236.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for hearing from Senate File 1236. This bill expands the crime of trespass to include crossing into or entering any public or private area that is cordoned off by police with for their purposes. It could be a barrier or a tape, a crime scene restriction, but we're talking about anywhere where the police have instituted some kind of a protection to protect the area from entrance. We would allow for that to become a trespass under Minnesota statutes. The current Minnesota statutes there's really a gap in what occurs here. If they could pursue under obstruction, they could pursue a trespass against someone who goes beyond a police tape, but they would have to actually show with an obstruction that someone actually interfered with the investigation or actually did harm to their work in order for them to prove the case. And so in some cases, some extreme cases, they can prove it. But short of that, they still have a difficult time establishing trespass for someone who has violated the police barriers. And so this bill would just clarify that we also intend that crossing or entering into one of those areas can be charged as a trespass. Madam Chair, Inspector Christine Arneson from the Minneapolis Police Department is here in to testify in support of this bill.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I want to do is put a real face on this. I was at the 35W bridge disaster within just a few minutes. Actually was on the bridge rescuing people. And the next, what we did immediately is we put up this tape, and it took us a while to get enough officers there to secure the scene. But what we had happen was people who crossed the barrier to go in and take pictures of victims or victims' vehicles. They wanted to talk to officers. Some of them were media, although that's not our concern. Some of them just wanted to get in and grab a piece of the bridge or any little memento they could find. And as you know, that area was we didn't know for several days how stable it was. So when people went across the barrier, we actually had to put ourselves in danger to go grab them and bring them back. And they were putting themselves in danger also. Just recently, we've had the Red River Valley floods, and people up there were actually crossing the tape also to do whatever they wanted to do. I'm not really sure why. I don't work up there. But again, they put themselves in danger, and they're putting law enforcement in danger also. As far as a crime scene goes, there are many things in behind the crime scene tape that people might not realize as evidence, and they could be stepping on it or moving it, and we really need to keep those folks back behind the tape. So thank you.
Officer, would there be a situation where somebody could unintended get caught into this? Say, I don't know. We're not out there every day, so I'm just trying to ask you, would there be a situation that somebody might get caught in the middle of this, us putting this prohibition in the books?
Madam Chair, if I could answer that question, or at least to begin the answer to that question, and the inspector certainly may have other responses as well, but the provision that you've got in front of you would actually include an affirmative defense that someone had permission to enter. And I also wanted to offer an author's amendment to get maybe at what you're getting at on line 3.4 of the bill. It explains what area folks are not allowed to enter and what would cause the trespass. At the little I, it says an area may be cordoned off through the use of tape barriers or other means conspicuously placed in identifying the area as being restricted by the police. I wanted to include the language right after the word police and identify the responsible authority. And that at least in part gets to your concern, Senator Moy and Madam Chair. What you don't want is folks coming across to a police area that's been cordoned off or a law enforcement area and not be able to contact law enforcement or know who's put the barrier up so that they can at least find out why is this area cordoned off. If this is my home, might want to call and find out. I want to know who's responsible for this so that I can hold them accountable for the decision that they've made to place this tape, and so that at least begins to address the concern that you have, Madam Chair and members. I hope that you would add that language at least as a start.
So what is the oral amendment again?
On line 3.4, after the word police and before the semicolon, add in the words "and identifying the responsible authority."
Ortiz. Singular.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
So does that mean that the police tape has to say police tape, or does that mean there has to be a sign? Or what does the addition, how does that piece work?
Well, Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, if it's a barrier, like a sawhorse or something like that, there's just a sign. Or if it's a police tape, maybe there's a card on there. Or, it could be Minneapolis Police, or maybe it's the Minneapolis Park Police, or maybe it's the sheriff's office. I mean, identifying who's responsible for putting the tape or the barrier up so somebody can ask that question. You know, if this is my home or this is a relative and I've gotten there, I need to know who to contact before. I mean, I might want to rush in and find out what's happening, but at least I can find out who's responsible for putting the tape or the barrier up, and I know who to contact. At least it's a start to that question of what happens if someone, unintentionally does that.
Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, just a suggestion. I think you might be wanting to say, and identifying the responsible authority, because I think that's what you're trying to identify, isn't it? You're trying to identify who it was that put the right. barrier up. Because as I read the sentence here, it was conspicuously placed in identifying the area being restricted by the police and identifying the responsible authority. So you would have both. I don't know right. by a... I got a little confused by that, but identifying the responsible authority, I think that that might read a little bit better, but I'll certainly...
Madam Chair, I agree. I thought that's what I said, so...
Oh, I thought you said by A. Okay. Okay.
Identifying the responsible authority.
Right.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay.
Got it.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Ortman. And I guess I'm surprised that this wasn't already... you know, something that was within the law, but now that you're making that change and making sure that it's clear, I just wonder if there's anything in this language that needs to make sure that it's clear to the public, I'm just wondering if we should have something in here that says that they have to identify it somehow as being a restricted area. I mean, it says if it is a restricted area, and it could be cordoned off through these other things, but should there be something that says that it has to say, you know, this area has been restricted by, you know, the responsible authority you're talking about, and no one is allowed to enter without the permission or something?
Madam Chair and
Senator Ortman.
Senator Olson, I think that's what provision 11 little I does. It says an area may be cordoned off. Through the use of tape, barriers, or other means conspicuously placed in identifying the area as being restricted by the police. I think that's what that does. It identifies the area as being restricted. And I'm just adding the language that they should also identify who restricted it. That you don't want it to be a question as to who's responsible for having made that decision to restrict an area.
Senator Olson?
So, Madam Chair, so you're assuming that identifying the area encompasses the fact that it would have some language or some warning that would be understood by a reasonable person as knowing that they shouldn't, that it is a restricted area.
I'll let the inspector answer.
Inspector?
Madam Chair. Yes, most of the time we use a very bright yellow tape that says police line, do not cross, and everyone knows what that means. There will be times where we might have to use sawhorses in a big disaster or event, possibly squad cars, and I think that's the time when we put some kind of notice on that says Minneapolis Police Department.
Inspector, I think Senator Olson was thinking that the next time you get those tapes printed, you might say, you know, police area, do not cross. You could get hit with trespass or something like that. I think she meant that, you know, on the signage, would there be an explicit statement now saying that it is now a crime of trespass if you cross this unauthorized or without you know, the authority to cross? Senator Olson, was that what you were indicating?
Well, Madam Chair, I think that's exactly what I was thinking along those same lines, that, you know, that we have those tapes and they say lots of things. We can buy them. I'm sure it wouldn't be that hard to have a tape that says it's a crime to pass this barrier or something like that.
So the next time, Senator Betzel.
I think those things are used nationwide. I mean, see them everywhere. So I don't know that they're tailor-made in Minnesota. And plus, too, if you have a situation where they're using the sawhorses or the squad cars or whatever, are we supposed to put a sign out there in front of them? I don't know if that's going to work. But I'm not quite sure that that's, you know,
well, I'm not necessarily indicating that we have to put that in statutory language, but I would think that the inspector and our law enforcement who does this, I mean, if you have the signs reprinted, I don't know why they wouldn't put that on there.
Madam Chair, duly noted. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Ortman, there's a 809-0375 amendment here.
Madam Chair, it's not my intention to offer that at this time. Rather, I've worked on the oral language that we just talked about, and I'm hoping that we can adopt that at this time. I would move that language.
So Senator Ortman has moved the oral amendment by inserting before the semicolon line 3.4, inserting and identifying the responsible authority. Any further discussions? Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I assume if I may ask Senator Artman, I assume you mean which police, because little I says identifying the area as being restricted by the police. That if I'm in Minneapolis, I'm assuming it's the Minneapolis police. If I'm in Brooklyn Park, I mean, we're already identifying it as being restricted by the police. I don't know that you need to do that. And I was going to ask the officer if firefighters ever need to do this as well. Do they ever cordon off?
Inspector?
Madam Chair, they usually do it at our direction if they're helping us. Yeah.
Madam Senator
Chair,
Ortman.
If I could just add, we have the U of M police, we have the Minneapolis police, we have the Minneapolis Park police, we have the sheriff's office, and I think it's just fair to ask that whoever has made the determination to cordon something off or block it off, that they take responsibility for that decision to do that and be the contact for it.
So, Senator Ortman, is the word peace officer broader than the word police?
I wondered that, too.
And if that's the case, why don't you insert, instead of saying the restricted by police, just go back to your original use the word of, up above you said by at the direction of a peace officer, so why don't we just repeat peace officer?
Madam Chair, I think that's acceptable to the inspector.
Right. Yeah.
So you'll incorporate that into your amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. Senator Scheid, does that?
That's fine, Madam Chair, although I suppose it is that one officer now that's responsible for doing that. I don't know if they have to identify themselves. I mean, now we're
Madam Chair,
it's getting a little tricky.
Madam Chair, I forgot the State Patrol, so forgive me.
I think, Madam Chair, police probably works there better.
Okay. Well, then.
No.
So.
I think peace officer works the right language.
And identifying.
Peace officer is
being
police officer. It would be the sheriff's or sheriff's deputies. That could be the state patrol.
The DNR.
Okay.
Madam Chair, the DNR. DNR.
Peace officer.
Well.
Peace officer.
I suppose.
Peace officer's right.
Peace officer.
Okay. Any further discussions? So Senator Ortman incorporates peace officer into that in her language. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair?
Will it say a peace officer?
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I just had this weird thought, and maybe it's just late and I'm out to lunch, but... I'm trying to remember whether at national night out parties people are given those, police yellow tape or anything like that, and whether that might, every time I go wandering into a national night out party, am I going to be breaking the law? Inspector Armstrong.
Inspector?
We do have an affirmative defense for that, and... frankly, we're not going to arrest anyone on national night out and charge them. So.
Except politicians.
that does open up the conversation about discretion.
Yes.
Discretion in the application of this law. I am concerned, though, Inspector, how long do you usually cordon off an area? I'm assuming that that's why the amendment here was interesting to me, because there's been instances where, I would drive through the neighborhood and I see police tapes up for several days. And, is so long as the tapes are up, people shouldn't be crossing the line? Or so usually how long are we contemplating the area being cordoned off?
Madam Chair, typically, if the police tape is up, we're there. If we're not there, we're not there to enforce it, and the tape should come down.
Okay. So have you seen this amendment language? Does this work to address the concern that you have in terms of protecting the area and the evidence?
With the trespassing?
Yes, with the trespassing. The amendment says that, so it's within 36 hours of the area first being cordoned off
Madam
at the
Chair.
Direction of peace officer. Senator Ortman?
I, I asked that that amendment be prepared because I had the same concerns you did. And then I was reminded that the activities up at the flood, or the activities at 35W Bridge, took quite a bit longer than that, and require a court order under those circumstances is adding a lot of the work to that. And so it made sense to me that because they always have a police presence as long as the tape is up, there's an officer there, and that means that they should be preserving the area. And I think I trust law enforcement. If they're going to have a physical presence there, then to require that. And folks can go in and get a court order to ask them to leave or to take down the tape. But I didn't want to put the burden on the law enforcement to go and get a court order to continue it longer than 36 hours, and that's why I didn't offer the amendment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
A possible suggestion would be something along the lines of where you have the affirmative defense language. You could add to that the affirmative defense. It could be an affirmative defense to a charge under this clause that a peace officer permitted entry into the restricted area, or that law enforcement had abandoned the area, or something along the lines of was no longer using it, you know, as a... So you could have that as an affirmative defense if that's
or
a concern.
Had a presence. Is that the
I'm just concerned that we should anchor this to the duration of whatever, you know, the law enforcement needs that for. And so whether, you know, we need it for 3 months, then it's for 3 months for the purpose that we need it for. If we only need it for 3 days, then it'd be 3 days. So I'm not sure I don't know how to anchor that yet, but we don't have to resolve it today. I'll think about it, and I'll work with Senator Ortman to see if something could be done. Any further discussions?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
And perhaps I need a little bit of guidance as to how the processes actually work in the field, because there could be just a myriad of situations that occur that, you know, the peace officers have to cordon off an area. And it may very well be that, you know, one particular peace officer tells a member of the media or somebody who lives on this particular street or whatever it is, yeah, you can go on in. And then somebody else says, wait a minute, what are you doing there? Now, it does say an affirmative defense, but what if one says it's okay and somebody else doesn't? I mean, does that ever happen? I don't know.
Madam Chair.
Inspector.
Usually when we let someone into the crime scene, inside the crime scene tape, they are escorted.
Okay.
We also have radios that say, you know, the homeowner's, you know, walking through. But typically they're escorted in. So that should not be an issue.
Okay.
All right. Senator Ortman moves that Senate file. Is there anybody else here who would like to be heard on Senate file 1236 as amended? Senator Ortman moves that Senate file 1236 be recommended to pass but be considered for inclusion in the omnibus bill. Yes, recommended for inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. Senator Ortman, is the companion traveling on its own?
Yes, it is, Madam
Chair.
In
the House? So we'll do both. We'll pass it, and then we'll put it in the Senator
I just
Ortman?
Had new information that it was in the omnibus bill. It did not pass on its
right.
own. So.
Oh, okay. So then we'll just put it in the omnibus bill. So Senator Ortman moves that Senate file 1236 as amended be considered for inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, for Senator Scheid, that was a 24 bill, wasn't it?
That's right.
Senator Betzel.
Okay. I haven't seen my segment from last night yet. I can't do it tonight.
No.
Too tired.
It'll be weekend. It'll be a long
time. Trust me.
Madam Chair, if I could do a Senate file 431 first. I think that's the quicker of the two bills. Senate file, and I do have, well, you've got the first engrossment, because that's the bill that came forward from the... Housing and Family Security Committee. I'll tell you the situation that caused this bill to arise and then discuss kind of the background. Representative Bingham in the House had a constituent who had her adult son was given a stay of commitment in Dakota County as a mentally ill person. And while he was under the stay of commitment, he was put into a clinical drug program through the University of Minnesota, and he decompensated, and apparently there's a lot of red flags on it, and ultimately he committed suicide. And there were some questions as to whether or not he should have even been in that drug program in the first place. The issues that arise out of this are this, that there's a Minnesota Supreme Court decision called Jarvis versus Levine back in the 1980s that gives that if somebody's under commitment and a physician prescribes medication, neuroleptic medication to them, the person has a right to refuse the medication and ask for a court hearing. In almost all instances, the court does approve the administration of the medication. But one of the provisions within Jarvis does say that it is not that people who are under commitment are not to be given part of clinical drug trials. I mean, they're not part of some experiment that's going on. This is actually medication that is used for treatment of that particular mental illness. When we get a person who's under a stay of commitment, the person is not committed. The person is basically agreeing to go along with certain conditions imposed by the court. And so that is why, in this particular case, the individual is under a stay of commitment, following the procedure, so this person was not committed, but then was put into this clinical drug trial program, which would not have happened if this person had actually been committed. So what it took a couple of runs to try to get the language here, and I think we've got it here in a way that we can do it, that basically it says a person who is under a stay of commitment is prohibited from giving consent because for a clinical drug trial program.
Sure.
At page 1, lines 21 and 22, because a person is competent, but you're mentally ill, so the decisions you make may not, you know, maybe be somewhat suspect. However, notwithstanding that prohibition that the person cannot consent to clinical program, we can do it because, frankly, there's reasons why we want to have people participate in clinical drug programs because we can learn things and find out if there's some medications that can adequately address the person, you know, mental illnesses to help better treat patients in the future. So the court may allow the consent in participation in a clinical drug program if the treating psychiatrist testifies or submits an affidavit that the patient may benefit from participating and after providing the treatment options that the other options are ineffective. So basically you've got to get some testimony. The treating psychiatrist has to sign off that there's a reason for doing that. And the problem that had happened in the case I cited was that the court was completely out of the loop. No one was aware that this particular patient was being given medications which was not established to treat the mental illness, and that's why the patient consented to it, but because he was mentally ill, his mother was concerned that, you know, why was he being allowed to participate in this program when it wasn't really proven that that was to be the case. So as I say, what this does is that this does allow a participation, but there's some controls on there, and the patient has to freely choose to participate. It's not done for any coercion, and the psychiatrist has to sign off on it. So that is basically the bill, Madam Chair, and the mother had actually wanted to come and testify. She's out of town right now, and I just said I think we'd be able to handle this. I've been working as a defense lawyer in the civil commitment area for close to 30 years, and I've talked to the lawyers like in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office and so forth, and I think we've got the language that I think that everybody is pretty comfortable with going ahead with because I think they're pretty concerned that it works. So that is the bill, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Betzolden. You know, I know this is always a very difficult balance between wanting to protect the civil rights of a person who's suffering from a mental illness and not be any more coercive than is necessary to protect their safety, and wanting to try to find medications and things that, you know, would be helpful to them to try to alleviate the symptoms of some of these illnesses. And I just wonder, I mean, there are usually at the time someone's going through a commitment proceeding like this, very often they wouldn't meet the definition of being competent almost by definition. You know, they're in a psychotic state.
They're, you know, and so I'm just wondering in that balancing if that's been discussed and thought about to make sure that we're not losing the opportunity to see what the impact of particular drug might be in helping a person to, you know, to come through a psychotic episode, for example, and so that's
Senator Betzel.
Sure. And Madam Chair, Senator Olson, when I was first approached to carry the bill, the original language had an outright prohibition, saying a person's under a stay of commitment may not participate. And I thought that was going way too far because I thought there were circumstances when we should permit that. And it's kind of a fine line sometimes because clearly a patient who is grossly psychotic, you know, clearly mentally ill, is going to get involuntary treatment. That is going to happen. But the trouble is some of these individuals do respond rather quickly when they start taking medications. They're in the hospital, the court proceeding is pending, but they start recovering. And they recover enough to be able to say that, okay, I'll cooperate with my doctor, I'll do the things that I need to do. And the law is structured to say that the courts should consider the least restrictive alternative. Commitment may be best, but in view of the civil liberties involved, if the person is willing to kind of go along, then that is what the court is required to do under the Commitment Act. So we've got a situation where somebody, you know, who is clearly suffering from a mental illness is volunteering to go along, but frankly may not be making the most rational decisions. And what happened in the case, as I say, prompted this one, was that the person agreed to participate in a program where, you know, probably people who are more rationally thinking would have said, wait a minute, we don't think that this is a good program for this individual. So we, you know, I think this is more protecting the patient to make sure that if a patient is cooperating, that somebody doesn't take advantage of that situation and lead to some awful results as what happened in this particular case. So it's a balancing act. It clearly is.
Any further questions? So Senator Betzel on Senate File 431. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, I have a question on 2.7 and 2.6 to 2.8. I'm trying to figure out whether this sentence that starts on 2.5, mm-hmm. the series that's on 2.6, whether that's a series of three items or a series of four items, because if it's four items, then we have a little grammar and punctuation to fix. So the court must determine that the patient is competent to choose to participate in a trial, that the patient is freely choosing to participate in the trial, that the compulsion of the stayed commitment is not used, da-da-da-da-da, and that a reasonable person, whatever. Are there four items, or is that middle one tied to, are the middle two tied together?
Because of the end.
You know, Senator Higgins, at my house, when my 9-year-old and I read together, we call that drama reading.
Mm-hmm. Drama reading?
Yes. To get at the different parts to mean what they really mean.
It's important, Madam Chair.
And Senator Higgins, Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, you're probably raising a good question, and I'll certainly ask counsel to take a look at this too, but perhaps, okay, starting on 2.5, the court must determine that under the circumstances, the patient is competent to participate in the trial. Maybe the semicolon should be there.
It's just a plain old comma.
Okay.
The question is whether on 2.7, after mm-hmm. the word trial, there should be a comma and delete the and.
I see.
To make it into a series of four.
Will you choose to participate? I think you may make a good point here that on page 2.7, after trial, put a comma and delete the word and. I don't think that the clause ties to and is necessarily going back only to that previous one. I think these are different elements.
Well,
freely choosing to participate, compulsion is not being used to coerce and participate. Reasonable person may choose to participate. So I think those are different elements, and perhaps you're correct. We need to.
Okay.
make that correction.
So Senator Higgins moves that on line 2.7, after the word trial, insert comma and delete the word and. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Any further discussions on Senate File 431?
I don't know if anybody else is here.
Anybody here would like to be heard on Senate File 431? Senator Betzel.
I move that Senate File 431 as amended be recommended to pass.
Refer to the floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. 1695, Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, we have for distribution an E4 amendment. Let me just advise the full committee of where we are on 1695 is a bill that relates to the business data harvesting law that we actually passed. We heard of this committee the past 2 years. We passed it last year, and actually it's on the books right now. It has an effective date of July 1st of 2009. So it has not gone into effect, but it's already passed into law. I've had people, since I was the author of this bill, had people contacting me during the session with some issues and concerns, some which were raised last year, some which were not. But I, like with any new law, I want to make sure that we've got it right before it goes into effect. As we were trying to get the omnibus data practices bill done before the first deadline, I realized that there wasn't sufficient time to accomplish that. So the omnibus data practices bill simply extended the deadline for the law out 1 year. But my commitment to the committee at that time was that I would continue working on this with the idea of coming back with revised language. If something passes out of this committee, it'll go to the floor but then be diverted to the Rules Committee because this would be classified as late bill. However, whatever language that the committee approves would be offered as an amendment to the data practices bill, which Senator Olson has on the floor. And obviously I want to make sure that the language we have is acceptable to her since this becomes her language, not mine, after this. So let me kind of review what we've got here. And I've talked to Senator Olson about this, and I know that she's got a concern or two, but let me just explain what we have through the A4 amendment. First of all, on page 1.6, again, we're talking about business screening services that collect information, usually criminal information, not necessarily, but usually criminal information. And then they put in their database when people want background checks or other things, and they provide it out there. But the trouble is sometimes they get it wrong at the outset. Sometimes they put information out there which is incomplete and needs to be updated. And in this electronic age, once the information goes out, you can't pull it back in. So we've got to have a system so that you can correct the information and have information that is going out that is going to be correct, because people's lives are going to be affected by it, whether it's their housing, their employment, their credit. A number of things can be affected by incorrect information going on out. So when we're talking about information, the law, as I say, says criminal record information. Well, I think it's more technical. I think we're talking about records. And as I say, we've stricken the reference on page 1.8 as defined in section 1302 because we've kind of rewritten that. Senate counsel, did this on page 1.13. So the strikeout on 1.8 would be tied into what's the 1.13. So that's technical. Criminal record means a public record because, again, that's really the information we're talking about is information that is generated in public by the courts. It's originated from a government entity or a Minnesota court. So we're trying to define exactly the records we are talking about. But it doesn't necessarily mean a court opinion. And I think maybe the word written might have to be in there because if, for instance, a decision is printed, whether it's a published or unpublished, if it's unpublished, as you know, it's still published, it's written somewhere, I don't think that that is the type of business screening information we want. If an appellate court has a published court opinion, that's going to remain on the books for as long as those written opinions are going to be out there for maybe hundreds of years. So we're not talking about that kind of data that we're collecting. We're talking about the fact that somebody was arrested, somebody was convicted, something, whatever happens in court, not necessarily the actual court opinion, which is the judge signing off on what actually happened. In Section 2, we had quite a discussion over the last 2 years about how often they have to update their information. We don't want them to just keep sending out stale information. What we talked about doing within 30 days. We finally amended it to saying they have to do it, update within the previous month. That may or may not get to the real heart of the problem. And so the language that we have in here is that they have to make a good faith effort to ensure the record that they are disseminating is accurate, complete, and current as it was provided by the government entity or the court. Now, current, accurate, complete, I think, speaks for itself. And, in fact, I'll give an example that Mr. Sikora provided to me, and he was the one who brought me the bill in the first place. He talked about an individual who had been picked up on a driving violation. The person did not have his driver's license. He claimed he was somebody else. The name he gave was a friend of his who was actually a soldier in Iraq. But that's what the police officer recorded. And so that's what went into the arrest records. It went into the database and so forth. It came to light when the soldier's mother was contacted about this, and she said, "What do you mean he's got a driving offense? I mean, he's been in Iraq for the past year." So in that particular case, the information that was recorded and went into the business screening database was correct to the extent that they correctly copied down the information and put it in the database and disseminated it, or to the extent it was disseminated. But it was wrong at the outset. So we want to make sure that information is accurate, it's complete, current. Now, current could mean a number of things, and I'm sure we're going to have some discussion on this. In my view, if somebody was arrested for something years ago, and 5 years later, it's disseminated, this person had this arrest and a conviction, say, it may be current information to the extent that it's 5 years later, but it's still good information. It doesn't necessarily mean it had to occur a month ago or a year ago or whatever. Now, something can change along the way. If a person had a criminal conviction and went to court years later and had it expunged, well, current information would then have to show that the conviction was expunged. It's not good enough to say this happened 5 years ago when there's been a change that happened later on, or if say something was changed on a court appeal. So accurate, complete, and current are some of the hallmarks in making sure that the business screening information is what it purports to be. Now, I've got some additional language saying that the screening service is not liable if they made a good faith attempt to comply with the section. And that's the situation I just cited, where they copied down the information absolutely right, they reported correct, but it turns out that it was wrong and there was no way that they would have known that it was wrong. Now, they've got a duty in the next section to make sure that when it comes to their attention, they correct it. But if they do everything by the book, they shouldn't be penalized for it if the underlying information that was provided by the government agency happened to have been wrong at the instance. Now, there is a section, as we provided in the statute, and that's Section 3, on correcting and deleting records. Now, we do have, as I say, it's in current statute. This kind of fleshes it out a little bit further, that the business screening company is required to determine whether records maintained accurately reflects the contact that is maintained. So they've got a duty to make sure that it is accurate when they get it, as much as they can. If, upon investigation, they determine it is not accurate, then the screening service has to correct the disputed record to accurately reflect the contact. I think this language gets to what we talked about previously. I think it's more descriptive of what the responsibilities are. And then in Section 4, and this is going to merit a little bit of discussion too, we have to make a decision because the law right now is not clear. Is the data that is currently in the pipeline, currently in the databases, data that's been collected for the last year, 2 years, 5 years, however long these organizations have been collecting data, how is that data to be treated? Are they supposed to go back through everything they've got in their database, find everything and make sure it's accurate, complete, because it might not be. Or are we only talking about data that is collected as of the effective date of this law, which right now is July 1st of 2009? I think we need to make a decision one way or the other how to treat the data that's already in there. And I think we're talking about the data that's collected by the Business Screening Service, because they're the ones that we are holding responsible for making sure that the information is accurate. I also indicated that the screening service that disseminates it have to include a notice that the criminal records may have been expunged, sealed, or otherwise, which is kind of a reworking of current law in there. So Madam Chair, as I say, a lot of people spend a lot of time on this. There are some people who still have some concerns, but I think most of the people who had an interest in this have talked to me, I think, are pretty much okay with the direction we're going. I just got to make sure it's okay with this committee, since we also spend a lot of time on this. So, Madam Chair, that is the A4 amendment. And actually, given the fact that this is the committee of origin for Senate File 1695, I would like to move the A4 amendment as an author's amendment, just to put the bill in the shape that it needs to be so we can have the further discussion.
Senator Betzel, do you want to incorporate into that written court opinion?
Yes, on page 1.12, after the word A and before the word court, I'd like to put the word written.
Okay. The A4 amendment is an author's amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Betzel is aware we had at least a short conversation during our break about the status of where his negotiations and have evolved to and where this language stands. But I just have to say, last year we spent a lot of time on this subject. We had very lengthy hearing on this in data practices, and I thought that we took a pretty strong position that we wanted to have a requirement that information had to be updated before it could be disseminated, so that, for example, if someone was identified as a suspect in a crime and they were later exonerated, that information that they were a suspect would not be continue to be sent out there. And I think when I was asked if we could have a hearing on this subject as the chair of data practices, I thought I made it clear that, at least from my perspective, I did not want to go back and revisit those substantive issues that we had already discussed at length last year, and that if there were some cleanup language issues that didn't go to substantive decisions we'd already made, that, you know, we could talk about those. But I didn't think or feel the need to go back and revisit decisions that were already made. And I would have to say that with respect to most of this bill, I think we are revisiting those decisions and substantially reducing the requirements that we have presently in law that would have gone into effect this year in 2009. The question of on line 1.18, and Senator Betzel and I talked about, you know, what it means to be current. Well, as this is written, it just says current as provided by the government entity or the court. So in other words, as long as the information was current at the time it was provided and wasn't old information, there's no requirement that anyone ever has to go back and update this information. When it comes to the updating part of things, that only happens under subdivision 3 if a person is disputing the information. So it changes the burden from the person who's selling the information to the person who's the subject of the information, and there would be no updating requirement unless that person actually complains. So I guess I just have to say I disagree with that. And then the last area that I have of disagreement that I think is a substantive change from what we decided last year is under subdivision 4, when it says that they would only have to update information that's collected from July 2009 on. I don't look at this at all as a retroactive law. I just look at it as from this point forward, when you start disseminating information, you have to make sure that it's accurate by updating that information. Not that you kind of get a pass on all the information that's already in your bank, don't have to update that information, and only have to update your new information. So it seems to me that what we just talked about last year, I thought I recalled, is that from that point on, we wanted people to start updating all their information as they disseminated it and sold it to make sure that it was an accurate reflection of the current status of that information. In other words, anything about it that might have been inaccurate or changed or was incomplete would be updated. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's what I recall of the substance of our conversation, and I think this would be a substantial step backward from that decision. And so I think there are some things in this that might be just those kinds of technical changes that Senator Betzel's talking about, but that the majority of this is really substantively different than what we passed. And so I guess the only parts of this that I think would be more just technical and perhaps an improvement on the discussion that we had or the meaning of what we had would be the corrections that are made under subdivision 1 section, or that would be made in section 1 and in section 4 except for the language on 2.16.
Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I share some of Senator Olson's concern, particularly on what it means, what current means. But I did have a question, and Senator Betzold, forgive me, I may have not heard you correctly. When someone has a conviction expunged, I thought you said they'd have to record that it was expunged. And I don't they just, and then I was looking at the language and I was kind of recalling, well, they just delete the record. So which is it, does it say this, you know, I mean, would it go forward saying this person was convicted of this, but on such and such date it was expunged? That's kind of,
well,
Senator Betzel,
and Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, you're hitting on an issue that I spent quite a bit of time trying to flesh out and figure out what do we mean. Now, expunged in Minnesota doesn't mean that the records are destroyed. It means sealed. However, if somebody has, say, a criminal conviction and they go through the process and a judge signs off an order saying the record's expunged, that really means from that point forward that record is sealed. It's not part of the public view, and that person should be able in any job application or any any housing application or whatever, if that person is asked, do you have, you know, any criminal convictions, this person ought to be able to say, you know, no to those issues. Because if it's expunged, that means that you can say, honestly say, I don't have them, because the court has kind of wiped the record clean as to that. What do you do, however, with the screening records that have collected the information correctly that the person had a conviction? They've reported it. Now, do they now just delete it out of the records and so it doesn't exist when it's already been put out there? Or do they have to say, you know, yeah, it was there, but it's been expunged? And those are critical issues to have there, because I don't know how it would look when they've already reported it. Somebody's got it in their own database that's there. You can't go into the third party's database and pull it out. It's going to be in there. So I think that there's going to have to be something that reflects that the record, yes, it existed, but it's been expunged. Now, I mean, a lot of people can debate this and figure out. I don't know typically how to do it. As I say, once you sent it out there saying that there's been a conviction, how do you pull it back in, even when there's been an expungement? This is going to be kind of a tricky thing to do. So I think there's going to have to be some recognition that the record has been clean, and just not reporting it anymore may not be the answer, because not reporting it doesn't take care of the information that's already been out there.
So, Madam Chair?
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, but the language at the top of page 2 does say the business screening service shall promptly delete the record. So, I guess you know it says that. But
sure.
And that's
something, as I say, and I don't know this bill or the law that's on the books is going to correct quite answer that whole question, because they can delete their own records, but how, does that delete the records that have already gone out? It doesn't.
No, Madam Chair, I think you can never get rid of the information.
No.
But it's forever.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, even though you may not be able to get rid of information that third parties have out there forever, it kind of defeats the purpose of an expungement if you're going to do what you're suggesting, Senator Betzold. And it seems to me that these services that are being paid to do background checks on people or give this information, that at least we can place upon them the requirement to do the best that can be done under the circumstances to try to honor the spirit of the law in terms of expungements, in terms of making sure that information is accurate, in terms of not labeling people incorrectly when time has shown, you know. And again, I would have to say I really think we spent a lot of time on this last session and made a decision that some people are just not in agreement with. And so I would just really urge the committee, I guess, to uphold the decision that we made and not to undermine the work that we did last session unless it's something that's really a technical change that's required.
And Madam Chair, maybe I should take another run at the expungement, because if you go to a court, they're not going to tell you, oh, we've got the record, but it's been expunged. They're just going to say there's no record. So I think what would happen as a practical matter is that they would check some records and say this person has no record, even though maybe previously they reported it. But that's where they have the responsibility to update their own records. Madam Chair and members, I do know that there are some people who have a strong interest, you know, in this area, and perhaps they should be given a brief opportunity to testify, recognizing, you know, we don't want to just redo the whole thing, but maybe they can, you know, just at least weigh in as to why they think that, you know, some of these changes are needed, and without going back and redoing all the work that this committee has previously done.
Well, you know, Senator Betzel, I think it would be helpful to hear from some of the businesses who are going to be affected by this, and it might be helpful for them to put on the record how they wouldn't carry out some of the language that's in the statute here. Okay. Because I think that we are concerned about how they would actually carry out some of this language. So who would like to come up and testify on this bill? Or perhaps take questions is more accurate. No takers? Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Reith Lebeau. I represent Thomson Reuters.
If we had a little bit more time, my apologies to those of you who are representing those businesses. I think it would have been better for us to hear directly from the businesses. So if we ask you some pointed questions, please don't take it personally. And our assumption is that you would then duly communicate this to your clients.
Absolutely. So. I will answer to the best of my ability.
So first, I would like to know how you or how your client would interpret Subdivision 2, particularly with respect to disseminating record that is accurate, complete, and current, as provided by the government entity or the court. Would you ascertain or make sure that the information is accurate, complete, and current when you give the information over to the person requesting it, or would the information be considered to be accurate, complete, and current at the time when you receive it from the government entity or the court?
What, particularly with the point as to the current part of that language, the way that I believe we all read it is that the information is current. We're looking for current information that is provided by the government entity or court, that essentially when they get new information, we'll get it. When they update it, we'll make sure that we're getting it. we will try to constantly work to make sure as they're updating information, we're making sure that our information is in Congress with what they have. So I think that gets at your question. As they're constantly making updating information with new records, we want to make sure that our information isn't becoming old or stale.
And is that the practice, that on a monthly basis, on a bi-monthly basis, once a year, the government data that is sold or given to you gets updated?
I believe it is. I can't speak for everybody, but I think as we've spoken with many of you about this issue, government agencies update their records at different times, and so we try to make sure that we're updating it as they're updating their information. In some cases, it is on every month. In some cases, it's a month and a half. I couldn't tell you what the farthest one out is, but I don't believe it gets into the area of 6 months to a year.
Mr. Tennyson?
Madam Chair, Robert Tennyson. I represent Reed Elsevier. We're at the mercy of the government entity when they update their data, and we get it as they get it, and we contract with them to obtain it. So it's updated on their schedule. And I think some of it's frequent, some of it's not so frequent, perhaps, depending on the origination. I think we get information from counties, police departments, things like that. Their schedule may not be the same as the BCA, for example. So we view that we get that we want the most current information available. That's what we use. Going back to a question that was raised earlier about expungements, in Minnesota, there's no central depository of expungements. We don't have an easy way to learn that. If somebody's had a record expunged or sealed, whatever the terminology may be, it may disappear from our files, depending on how they do the dump of update. Otherwise, we don't know, and the only way we find out is when the individual who's had his record expunged comes and tells us and says, I've been expunged, and we honor that.
So the process of government updating and then you updating when they're updating, but if the government updating system doesn't work necessarily to catch some instances, then you don't have a very reliable system.
Well, Madam Chair, we use the official government record, and we can't change the official government record. We have to rely on that. If there's an error in the government record and it's brought to our attention, we're obligated to reinvestigate. Because most of this employment and housing is all covered under fair information practice principles anyway. So this is somewhat on top of that, but I'm sorry. Could you repeat your question, sir?
Well, you just said that when a record is expunged,
right?
You don't really have a way to get notification of that. So that means that the government doesn't really have a good system in place to catch these status changes along the way. So I'm not reassured that, and it's not because you have a bad system, because your system piggybacks on the government system. But we're not in here where you're not able to catch the changes the government has made by relying on the government system. So I am not. What you're saying is, let us do this and exert our good faith effort, because we're pairing the updates we're doing with the government system. Well, the government system doesn't work. So I'm not reassured that your good faith effort, whatever, is really going to accurately capture or completely or currently capture the information.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the government record, they come to us in various ways, and I think that different companies deal with it differently in terms of the method by which you update it. Some may be a total dump, in which case all the records that show up and they replace whatever's there before. So if somebody's record's been expunged, it won't be there. In other cases, the way the information comes, it may not work that way. And we may have to only get some changes. Well, if there's no change, we don't see those. We can't change. We only publish public information. We don't publish other information. If the public record is inaccurate, there's nothing we can do about that. It is what it is. And we can't show a record, certify some sort of a record to the public that's different from the government record. I'll give you an example of the problem I had once in a pro bono case I had where somebody's record was inaccurate in a credit report for housing. And it was obvious it was inaccurate because it had the wrong person. And I called the credit bureau to have it corrected. They said, well, we're relying on the official court records of Cook County, Illinois, which they did. They said, we can't change the official record. You have to go back to Cook County and correct the record because they're only reporting what's the public record. I don't see how anybody can report as official status something other than what the public record is if they report to get their information from the public records. I think obligation on us, and this obligation is also imposed on us by the Fair Credit Reporting Act, where we have to maintain current records and have procedures and all that, and a person has a right to see and correct it, that sort of thing. So it's not new to us. But the problem is an inherent problem in the system, the governmental system, is how often does the government update its records, and how often is that available to us? I think our standard, the policy generally is to update as often as we can get it because that's what's more important to us. But if the government doesn't update the data, we can't change it. We're only reporting official record information.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, well, just a couple of responses I have to that are questions. I mean, it seems like what's being reported here is just kind of, as you said, just kind of a dumping, an accumulation of information as it comes in, rather than necessarily any kind of cross-referencing or correcting of the information unless someone specifically complains about it being inaccurate. So, you know, with the changes that are being made to this bill, First of all, I guess I would think government information isn't necessarily updated on a monthly basis or a six-month basis. I would think government information is kind of updated as it occurs. You know, if something happens, it's entered into the system. If someone's charged, if they're arrested, if they're convicted, as it happens, it's entered in. And so the idea was to make sure that you're going back and visiting that information, because I'm sure you're not doing it on a daily basis. We wanted you to do it on at least a monthly basis. So to say that you can't control how often they update it, well, they probably update it every day, but we're not asking you to go back and check on it every day. We were asking you to check on it once a month. And we were also trying to make sure that there wasn't just an accumulation of information out there that was continuing to be in the future perpetuated when there had been changing circumstances that would lead someone to realize that that initial information really wasn't portraying an accurate picture of the situation, and not to have your business just be able to continue to dump this information out there that gave a false impression of the situation without any responsibility over the accurateness of that information.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Tennyson.
Senator Olson, perhaps the use of the word dump is not the best one, but it's one that's used to describe how a database is turned over. It's not like it's a garbage dump. It's how it's transmitted. We get, when I say we receive it as the government's willing to permit it or give it to us, I think a standard practice is to have a contract with the government to get the information as often as they're willing to provide it. We can't change their schedule. So we update it as it becomes available from the government. That's their decision, not ours. If they wanted to make it available to us every day, we'd be happy to do that. But that isn't, I don't think that's a standard way it's done. So when the government updates its, you're right, the government updates its records as they occur. Except in Hennepin County, if you got a judgment, you can't get it entered for 6 months because they don't have enough staff to do it, but that's a different issue. So we do get the information when the government is willing to give it to us under a contract and so it is updated. Is there a standard time when the governments do that? I don't know that there is. I think it's fairly frequent. And it may be different for the Hennepin County Sheriff's Department than it is for Ramsey County or your county. I don't know the answer to all that. But we get it in different ways. And we get it as often as we can. And we try to have it as accurate as possible. We have that obligation now. And this issue came about because of the concern about employment and housing. Those are also issues covered by the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which we already comply with. So I don't, we're not trying to have inaccurate information or outdated information. We only get it when the government provides it to us.
Well, maybe members, if the government information is what's bad, then we ought to just prohibit government entities from selling their records.
Works for me.
I think that's the way to go. Because if our governments don't have the funding and the resources to keep their information accurate, this is a product that these businesses are buying from government. And if government can't keep its product in shape, then maybe we ought to just prohibit it from being sold. And then the businesses can get their information wherever they get them from. Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I'm often a frequent user of the Hennepin County Sheriff's website that lists the foreclosure sheriff sales on it, and was talking to one of the sheriffs recently and was complaining about how they're, this was like a month ago, and there weren't any 2009 sheriff sales entered yet. And, it's a fact of life that with our economy in the shape that it's in, there are fewer people to do the work that is now, exploding. So as a, just a matter of common sense, we have to realize that this data isn't being updated as often as we think it should or we expect it should or we want it to. And, that's just a fact of life at this point, and I don't know how we get around it. I think that the phrase good faith effort is just squishy, and I don't know if there's anything we can do about it or whether we should do anything about it or whether we should get it started and see how it works. I just don't know.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I might add one thing, you posed a hypothetical about closing all the data, and you could do that. Of course, the problem would be that this data is used for purposes of commerce. When people grant credit, they do other things. The information is used for a lot of purposes. You would make that information more inaccurate, and you would impose a big price on society if you did that. Because in that case, then, when somebody's trying to deal with, make a loan or hire somebody provide housing, they wouldn't know what the risk was.
I understand
that. Information about criminal records would be out of the newspaper or someplace else. I don't know where we would. I'm not an expert in how they gather all this information and all the logarithms for coordinating and all that. But It has to come from somewhere, and we don't. We're not a country with private criminal system. It's a public system for holding people accountable.
Well, I understand that, Mr. Tennyson, but we have to balance that against inaccurate information that's being used to redline people from being able to afford insurance premiums and being able to get good credit. And so that's the balance here. And if you and the businesses are not the problem, you're just trying to do your job based on really bad information that you're getting from the government, then we should just go straight to the source. Senator Ortman, Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, as a possible compromise for Senator Betzel to consider and something that I could live with, I would suggest as a compromise that we accept the language in Section 1, and that in Section 2 we stick with our original language, except that we change it to say, instead of within the previous month, we say within the previous 90 days, because the testimony has been, you know, that sometimes it isn't a month, sometimes it's 2 months, but the 6 month to a year really doesn't enter into the picture, so 90 days seems to me to be quite reasonable. And then that we also, on subdivision 4, accept the new language, except for the language on 2.16. So in other words, we include the language to clarify that it is collected by the business screening service, but we do not accept the fact that they don't have to update information that's already in their files. That would be my suggestion.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
I appreciate Senator Olson's comments. Just on Section 2, I mean, I really like the idea, and I would hope that we could have worked the words verify accurate, complete, current, or if not current, at least verify accurate, complete in the books. But, you know, if that's not the will of the committee, I can understand that. I just would like to clarify what would be the opposition to what is added to Section 3, however, because I think that Section 3 seems to be just being more descriptive of it. I don't see that as a deviation from what we had adopted, but maybe I'm just reading it a bit differently than maybe others have.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I don't really have an objection to Subdivision 3, I guess, if we make those other changes. I just didn't like it with the other changes, because then I think there was no obligation to really make an update of the records unless someone complained. And so I guess under those circumstances, Senator Betzold, I would agree with you that we could have the language in subdivision or Section 3 as well.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm inclined to go along with Senator Olson's suggestion, but again, there may be other people who are here who want to weigh in, so before we make a motion, maybe we could see if anybody else is here to...
I think, Senator Betzel, what Senator Olson is suggesting is that we just delete subdivision 2, section 2, from your amendment. And if we do that, that just keeps current law, doesn't it?
Well, Madam Chair, I think she was saying keep subdivision 2, but reinstate
the stricken language.
Change that from previous month to 90 days, and then delete the new language, if I understood her suggestion.
I think that section is the problematic section, Senator Betzel.
And then adopt Senator Betzel. Section 3 as is, adopt Section 4, except delete on 2.16 that is collected on or after July 1st of 2009. And obviously Section 5 we need to adopt because the bill that we sent to the floor delayed the effective date, and so you want to have it go back into effect. And we need to... What we would do on the floor, I would guess, is just to strike the section that is currently in the omnibus bill, because all that does is delay the effective date and then have new language in here.
Okay. Discussion, members?
So unless anybody else wants to be heard, I would make that motion.
Just want to clarify in Section 4.
Further discussions, members? Yeah. Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to clarify what's going on in Section 4. Because that was actually divided into two sentences, because the July 1st date was only intended to the requirement, to apply to the requirement that they include the date when the record was collected, when it's released. So that's not the whole section, all records. So it's just that if the record's collected on or after July 1, 2009, it must include the date when the record was collected.
That's not what that says.
I think that can stay.
Yeah.
I think that can stay, Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
I was understanding when Senator Betzel and I talked about this that the intent of putting that in there was so that they would not have to update records that were collected later. If it's just including a date when the record was collected, I wouldn't have an objection to that.
Okay. I think that Section 4 can stay. Okay. Senator Higgins?
I think we all misread it, though, so I'm not sure that that we couldn't do a little work to it, maybe.
I'm okay with Section 4.
I'm okay with the concept, Madam Chair. What I'm saying is that we all misread it. So maybe something like if a business screening service disseminates a criminal record that is collected on or after the date, it must include the date when the record was collected, or at least that makes it a little clearer in my mind.
Okay, Senator Betzel, you'll incorporate that?
Yes.
All right. Any further discussions?
With leeway to counsel, if those exact words don't work.
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, so I'd read, if a business screening service disseminates a criminal record that is collected on or after July 1, 2009, comma, it must include the date. Is that it?
Yeah.
Senator Higgins?
I think all right. That would do it.
So insert if, delete that on line 2.15. And then on line 2.16, after the comma, insert it.
Section 2, this is just 90 days instead of.
Right. And then on section 2, restore the stricken language, strike the new language. Down to the period, and then delete
month,
and insert 90 days. Any further discussions on Senator Betzel's motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, assuming there's no one else who would want to be heard on it, I will move that Senate File 1695, as amended, be recommended to pass. Again, with the understanding that it's a late bill, it's going to be going to the Rules Committee, so when we get to the floor, I would have a floor amendment having this revised language offered to the omnibus data practices bill that Senator Olson is carrying.
And you won't go liberate this bill from the Rules Committee.
I don't need to see it again.
That's right. Senator Higgins?
Is there a reason why we just can't include it in the public safety omnibus bill?
It's a public safety bill. This is a civil.
It's a data practices.
It's a data practices bill.
It belongs really to the data practices bill.
So, on that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you, Madam.
Okay.
Senator Betzel, thank you for working so hard on this.
My pleasure.
You lie.
Madam Chair and members, I want to take up Senate File 1452. Senate File 1452 deals with some changes to the Safe at Home program. that we passed. It's a program that we've done some work on in the past to put in. I think this is the second time that I've carried a bill to modify the Safe at Home language. The Safe at Home program is a program that was established in house with our Secretary of State's office to give some protection to individuals who are in need of having a different address for purposes of their safety and protection. In the instance of, say, somebody who is being stalked, the Secretary of State's office worked with them to give them an anonymous P.O. Box address while keeping their correct address with an advocate in instances for emergency purposes, but for purposes on their driver's license and for public purposes, they have an anonymous P.O. Box address. We established this program for that purpose. And what we've had to do is, as the program has been implemented, we've had to come back and tweak with different aspects of the statute to make sure that the program really does what it does. So the bill before you today does four main things. It excludes predatory offenders from participating in the program, and that's in Section 1 of the bill. We think that most predatory offenders probably be deterred from joining the program anyways, but we felt that it was important to predatory offenders, there's nothing in the statute to stop them from participating in the program anyways. This was just, we just want to make them ineligible for the program. And I think they'll tell you why we came up with the rationale is for that. What was the rationale for keeping them out of the program?
Madam Chair and members, Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. With limited resources,
that's right,
predatory offenders have to make their address at least semi-public. And so if we're trying to help people keep their address private, it doesn't seem like a good use of public funds.
That's right. And then the second purpose is to ensure that local ordinances and landlords cannot require the display of participants' names at their addresses. And we're finding that in some cities, local ordinances, particularly in big apartment complexes, are requiring, you know, the names of the tenants with not their direct telephone number, but a dial into their apartments posted on the outside. So when you come up, you look up, you know, Higgins, Linda, dial 333, and it'll ring into their apartment. Well, it defeats the whole purpose of keeping them anonymous if their landlord is posting their name and their unit or their dial-in telephone number on the building. And so we're hoping to address that issue. Issue number three also addresses the local ordinance issue by prohibiting landlords and local government entities except in the instance where we're responding to a specific request in connection with an active investigation or inspection of an alleged code violation that has been committed by the participants. We prohibit the landlords from providing the participants' names to local government entities. And then the fourth issue also ties in with that, where whenever a landlord releases a program participant's name to a local government entity, we're requiring that the participant's name and address are classified as private data, and that's in Sections 2 to 4 of the bill. The Secretary of State's office has worked really hard with the League of Cities, the Multi-Housing Association, and local law enforcement to craft this language, and that is the bill. And Ms. Frazier from the Secretary of State's office has been with us all night, and she's, you know, willing to take testimony on the bill, but I think the bill is pretty short, and that's the substance of the bill. And Madam Chair and members, the substance that I've just explained is in the Delete Everything A1 amendment, which I will move to put onto the bill as an author's amendment.
Senator Moi has moved the A1.
Oh, I'm sorry. Madam Chair, I guess there's one amendment to it. There's a sentence that's a leftover from the original bill and the effective date.
That's right. And I will incorporate that into the A1 amendment, and that is on the second page, Ms. Pontius?
Yeah, Madam Chair, yes, it's on page 2, line 25 and 26. That second sentence Section 3 applies to actions pending on or commenced on or after it needs to be deleted because that section's no longer in the bill.
That's correct. So I will incorporate that into the A1 amendment.
So Senator Waugh moves the A1 amendment as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
And that is the bill, Madam Chair.
So Senator Waugh moves Senate file
1452
as amended be recommended to pass and be laid over for, or is this going to the floor?
This will go to the floor.
Okay. And be referred to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman? Senator Ortman moves to reconsider the motion by which Senate file 1236 was passed. Senator Betzel, is that how?
Where are we going? Or
Senator Ortman would like to reconsider Senate file 1236. She has language at the end of it. She's been working on it since we moved the bill. So Senator Ortman moves to reconsider the motion.
Did she vote on the prevailing side?
Having voted on the prevailing side.
I think it was my motion, so I'm pretty sure I prevailed.
Having voted on the prevailing side, Senator Ortman moves to reconsider the motion by which Senate File 1236 was
recommended to
pass. Now the bill is before us, Senator. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
Motion.
I'm
motion prevails unanimously.
It's getting late.
Senator Ortman, the bill is now before us.
Yes, Madam Chair. After consideration of the committee's discussion about the affirmative defenses and making sure that people knew that the police had left or something like that, I worked with Inspector Martin and folks from the City of Minneapolis to offer an additional provision with the affirmative defense clause, which is double little I, so two little I's after Section 11 on line 3.5. We have on 3.6 relating to an affirmative defense to a charge under this clause that a peace officer permitted entry into the restricted area. I wanted to add the language after the last word, or there was no peace officer present at the site. So in that sense, members, we know that the site has been abandoned by police officers. They don't feel there's a need to continue it. And so if someone comes across the site and there's no peace officer there, that should be an affirmative defense to a charge of trespass. So members, again, on line 3.7, after the last word area, add in the words, or there was no peace officer present at the site. And that would be my motion, Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman moves that language. Any discussions? See none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Now, Madam Chair, I would move that this bill be included in the omnibus public safety bill, which was the last one on the agenda.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Ortman, thank you for working on that language.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Ms. Erdman, Ms. Munyon. Member, Senate File 993 is the vehicle for the Omnibus Policy Bill. It is the companion to the Omnibus Policy Bill in the other body. In years past, this committee, in the past year, this committee did not put together an Omnibus Policy Bill, because we never got notice of the jackets to, or the companion to the omnibus policy bill that just sort of came up in the other body. But this year, Representative Hillstrom has been in communications with us and has indicated to us which of the jackets is the companion. And so in consultation with her, we've agreed to make this Senate file or the companion to her omnibus bill be this Senate file. And so we're trying to put together an omnibus policy bill in order to have an opportunity to have a discussion with her. The reason why we're doing this is because it's always been the policy of this committee that we let the authors take their bills to the floor because they've worked really hard on it. Unfortunately, some of our bills that we've passed, not only out of this committee, but in fact, some bills have passed off of the floor, but they don't have live companions to get matched up to. So if we don't do an omnibus policy bill to contain their language, we really don't have any way of protecting our members' work. And so this is our attempt to do that in collaboration with Representative Hillstrom. So as a way to process that, what I would like to do is Senate File 993 is a pretty small bill, and I'll have Mr. Erdman and this other witness speak to Senate File 993. And then if one of my co-authors would move the bill after our discussion,
sure,
then what I would like to do is pass out a delete everything amendment and explain the content of the delete everything amendment that would become what our omnibus bill is going to be. So, Mr. Erdman, can you just briefly walk us through Senate File 993, giving us the rationale for why we need to do this?
Certainly, absolutely, Madam Chair. Thank you. My name is Ryan Erdman. I'm the Director and Legislative Liaison for the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties. This is a pretty straightforward bill. We have this authority in the Community Corrections Act to issue what's called an apprehension and detention order. It's something probation officers are able to issue to enforce discipline or to keep a person on conditional release from escaping or absconding. It's something that's been in the Act for as long as the Act has been around. Recently, a county attorney in a single county issued an opinion that because of the way it was phrased, those orders would only be valid in the county that issued the order. These have frequently been used in a situation where a county issues it for an offender that is in a neighboring county, but doing some behavior in violation of their probation. It should be noted several other county attorneys disagree with that interpretation, but the fact is, with that opinion, it was our decision that we really thought it would be useful to clarify this statute to make it clear that these orders are valid in any county, not just the county that issued the order.
And Ms. Erdman, that in fact is the practice.
That is in fact the
practice. Despite what the statute says.
That is in fact the practice currently and has been for quite some time.
And then, members, there is an A4 amendment for your consideration. And the A4 amendment does
substantially change the bill.
Can you tell me your name again?
Steve Pekoy, Chisago County Court Services.
And Ms. Pekoyevich, are you going to speak to the A4 amendment?
I am.
Okay, so
we don't have it.
Yep, we're passing out the A4 amendment.
I was just telling you.
That's okay. We'll pass out the A4 amendment. And so, Mr. Pekoyevich, can you speak to the A4 amendment?
I can. Again, my name is Steve Pekoy. I'm court
Pekoy.
Service director for Chisago County, and I'm also the legislative chair for the Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers. This amendment is simply it's one of these things that just kind of makes sense. We're simply doing is including similar language on Senate File 993 and setting it up so that it would also modify language in the Minnesota Statute 244195. It includes the same basic changes for the same basic reasons as Mr. Erdman stated, but it applies these changes to the other 55 non-Community Corrections Act counties in the state. This amendment would clarify that A and Ds, as we call them, apprehension detention orders, from these 55 counties would also be accepted statewide. It also establishes consistency with the Community Corrections Act counties and also with the Department of Corrections statutes, which is under a 243. So there's three separate ways of doing these ANDs. This results in some consistency and makes them all statewide, which was the issue.
And Mr. Pekoy, the bill as introduced only covers the CCA counties, and what you're doing here is we're just taking this statewide.
Exactly.
Okay. Any questions for the two witnesses? Senator Limmer?
Madam Chair, could you tell me what the repealer is? Did you cover that in your presentation?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Mr. Erdman? Oh, Mr. Pecoy?
Yes, the repealer is Section 5. This is the this statement only pertained to the 244 section. What it was is a couple of things. Basically, the statute allows detention, release, and then it's specified for pretrial release. Sub 5, which we're seeking to delete, talked about the ability to issue an AND in four specific situations. And our thought was that, frankly, this isn't used very, very frequently. One of the situations was if a person fails to report at a local correctional facility, that's typically handled by the probation folks anyway. The second one was someone failing to return from furlough or authorized temporary release from a local correctional facility. That's sort of a jail custody thing, and they take care of that. The third one was escapes from a local correctional facility, again, a jail custody issue. And the fourth one was absconding from court-ordered home detention, which is something the probation folks would take care of anyway. Then there was another statement in here that talked about the ability to issue the AND for pretrial, which is already in Subdivision 4. So we're just trying to clean up some old language. And the court service directors that I spoke to about this when we decided to go this route, they said they've never used those anyway, so let's just try to delete that section.
Madam Chair? Chair?
Oh, sorry. Yes, Senator Limmer?
Mr. Erdman, have you talked to any police officer associations regarding these changes?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I did speak with the Sheriff's Association and was told that they agree that, in fact, this is the way they've been conducting business and they had no problem with this change.
So, Madam Chair, just so that I don't have to rule on someone else moving an amendment to my bill, I'll move the A4 amendment.
Senator Ma moves the A4 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, that's the bill. And
Madam Chair?
Senator Betzold?
Senator Ma, before you go any further, how did you get so many co-authors for such a simple little bill that we had before us? I mean, there's a lot of folks here.
Well,
I'm one of them. I
Madam
don't remember.
Chair and Senator Betzold, maybe I had the foresight to see that this bill was going to become the omnibus policy bill.
Good answer.
So why
Madam
did
Chair, I'm feeling really left
so,
out now.
So yeah, no. So why did all these people sign on to it then?
Foresight, Senator Limmer. You all have the delete everything amendment, and what was so the Senate file 993 is before us. Is still before us. You all have the Delete Everything Amendment to Senate File 993, and you have a document attached to it. In this list, you will see I've given you a list of the Senate file numbers and the authors and the titles. This list contains all the bills that we have passed in this committee, and as I mentioned before, a number of which have passed even the floor. And, once these bills are on the floor, I think that it's up to the Majority Leader's Office and the author whether or not they want to also present the bill and get it off the floor, but it will now be part of our public safety omnibus bill. I've not included any bill in here that we have not passed in committee. And then I believe, Senator, what I'm going to have to do is delete everything amendment, Mr. Backus can correct me, also contains the language of Senate File 993. Is that correct, Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair and members, yes, it does. It includes the original language of Senate File 993 and the original language of Senator Ortman, Senate File 1236. So I believe it would be my intent to put the most recent version of both bills in here tomorrow for the committee report.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I want to ask Senator Moore. I thought I recalled that the bill that Senator Torres-Ray had here, their day or evening, I think late last week, was going in here as well as on its own. I don't know. Maybe it's not this bill.
No.
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, I think that Senator Torres raised bill on prostitution. That was going on its own and being included in Senator Pappas's human trafficking omnibus bill. So that's a different omnibus bill.
Thank you. Yes.
So I believe the, Madam Chair members, the proper motion would be I move that the A1 amendment, the delete everything amendment, I move the A1 amendment.
Mr. Backus has a comment first.
Madam Chair and members, there are two other technical corrections you would want to make, if you could, to the A1 amendment. On page 15, line 7, the first citation, I crossed it out, so I can't really see what it is, 13.87.
Three.
Whatever. Okay. That needs to be 13.87. And that was pointed out by the department. Oh. And then similarly on page 43, the line 15, I think it's 13.42 needs to be deleted and insert 13.384.
And what line was that, Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, that was 43.15.
Okay. So, any questions or discussion?
Madam Chair, just a question.
Senator Bitzold?
Mr. Backus, page 15, 13.873 is twice in that line. Is it just the first one that was going to be 13.87 or both of them?
Yes, I'm sorry. Senator Betzold, it was the first one.
The first one, thank you.
And that should read again 13.87 now.
Gotcha. Thank you.
So, on that oral amendment,
Madam Chair, Mr. Backus, can you repeat the change on line on page 43 again?
Madam Chair, on line 43, I'm sorry, page 43, line 15, delete 13.42 and insert 13.384.
384. Of course. Okay. Madam Chair, I incorporate that into the A1 amendment.
Okay. So then Senator Moy moves the A1 amendment as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
And then Madam Chair and Senator Madam Chair, I guess I would ask for advice from Senator Betzel with respect to the bills that are already in delete everything amendment that we amended in committee, Senator Ortman's bill and my bill. Could we, as we make the changes in the delete everything amendment to Senate File 993, just have council incorporate those changes?
Madam Chair, I believe that the motions were Senator to Betzel. Incorporate them into 993, so I think that's already been done. I guess you'd have to double-check what those motions were. Lay it over for possible inclusion doesn't necessarily do it, so maybe we should just clarify that everything that was laid over for possible inclusion is to be included, so just so there's no question about that. So
we will...
Madam Chair, I will move that everything that we laid over for possible inclusion in 993 actually be included in Senate File 993, whatever that was, whatever those bills were.
And any amendments that we made on those bills be incorporated into this bill as well?
I don't know.
Okay. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
And then, Madam Chair, I don't have any other amendments except that I believe Senator Ortman was contemplating an amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair and Madam Chair, I have an amendment.
It's the last thing between us and the door. Okay, go ahead.
The A3 amendment.
A3.
Members, the A3 amendment addresses the issue that was brought forward in Senator Moy's original bill regarding aggravating factors for sentencing. And if you remember, it was an aggravating conversation that we had. We couldn't really understand exactly what we were trying to get at there. And I was so interested by what the county attorneys had said and by what Mr. Stewart had said that I decided to go back and read the Supreme Court case that brought out the controversy. And I understood by reading both the majority opinion and the dissent opinion that there was a pretty big
gap in their views of what we authorized for departures from our sentencing guidelines. And so A3 is offered with that in mind to clarify that the legislature does anticipate that aggravating factors where they've been proved to a jury, as required by our U.S. Supreme Court, that when they've been charged and proven to a jury, authorize the judge then to sentence beyond the sentencing guideline limits. And that was the question in that case. So what the A3 amendment does is it lists out all of the aggravating factors that are included in our sentencing guidelines. So we are codifying what is authorized under the sentencing guidelines. And then we make certain that the aggravating factors that might be available to a prosecutor for charging are not limited to those in the sentencing guidelines, that they may seek to prove other types of aggravating circumstances. The operable language, members, is in sections B and C on page 2 at the bottom, lines 2.30 through 2.35. And what section B does, it's basically where it says that the court may order that aggravated sentence then beyond the top limit of the sentencing guidelines. So the sentencing max is not a maximum, a hard maximum, that the aggravating circumstances can authorize a sentence beyond that. And then section C says that if there are other aggravating factors that have developed as a matter of case law that aren't codified here, those are still available. They still have to meet all the other procedural protections, and the charging protections still have to be charged to a jury. So this is not an exhaustive list, but it's everything that's in our sentencing guidelines, plus two more that the county attorneys were aware of that are used frequently that were not included, and those are items 13 and 14 at lines 2.27 and 2.28. 13 was the offense committed in the presence of a child, and 14, the offense was committed in a location in which the victim had an expectation of privacy. And if you remember the case and the controversy that was brought here, was that was one of them, was the zone of privacy with the robbery that was involved in the underlying case. So this is really intended for us to clarify our intention that the top of our sentencing guidelines is not a maximum, but that certain cases can qualify offender for a larger sentence, a longer sentence, in the presence of aggravating factors proven to a jury.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, we did have some testimony that there was some case that is, and you said you've read the opinions, but is this the case that is on appeal to the Minnesota Supreme Court now? That may or may not tie into this issue?
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Betzolt. I'm referring to a case that was decided with finality May 30th, 2008. Okay. And so I'm clarifying the controversy that came up in that case between the majority and the dissent about this very issue.
Senator Ortman, does this language reflect the majority opinion or the minority opinion or...
Thank you, Madam Chair. The county attorneys are here. My intention was to broaden our discussion so that it didn't fall into one of those categories, being a position of the dissent or the majority, the county attorneys, or the defendants, but rather to say we support the Sentencing Guideline Commission, the aggravating factors in our sentencing guidelines. That's why they're all listed, plus others that have developed over law or over the course of time through case law. And that this list is not exhaustive, but I think that it's appropriate for our legislature to issue a statement clarifying that we support the aggravating factors in our sentencing guidelines. And then the clarification that it can qualify someone for a sentence over the maximum.
Senator Moy?
Madam Chair and members, the original language that's introduced was my bill. After we heard testimonies in the committee, I laid it on the table because I felt like the testimony was conflicting. I am neither, against nor have taken a position for this amendment. I think that Senator Ortman has worked really hard to try to put this issue into shape, and I wanted to respect her by giving an opportunity for her to present this. All of the bills that we have in the omnibus bill have been vetted through the committee, have passed the committee, and so this the A3 amendment is the only addition to 993 that has not passed this committee. So that's why I have not, no one's asked, but I think I have the most bills have been tabled in this committee, and I'm and so you know, I've had Senator Ortman, I mean, she's done a lot of work on this, and I think that if there are anybody here who would like to speak on this or try to answer our questions, if there's a way we can accommodate the work that Senator Ortman has done, I'm willing to do that. But if it's problematic, you know, we should indicate that to Senator Ortman too. And I don't want to end up putting something into this bill that it's going to be problematic.
Madam Chair, if I could make one more point that
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The House did pass the language that we saw before, and I did not think that that was a very that was a broad enough approach to this issue, and that's why I thought that I would work on this issue. I don't want to see what got passed in the House become law without a much broader discussion of it, and one of the reasons why is many years ago I worked in a prison law library. I mean, what we have in our statutes should be available to anybody so that they can understand what's happening in our sentencing. And I think that if we codify this, we make the law accessible to everybody, lay people or not. You don't have to be a lawyer. You can go to the statutes and you can understand what happened here. But I think short of that, we've done a disservice by putting in cryptic language about what our aggravating sentences are and about when they can be charged and when they can't be charged. So I didn't particularly favor that language. And I think that it is incumbent upon us as legislators to create some clarity if it looks like there is a gap. And I do think after reading the decision that there is a clear gap.
I keep expecting Senator Moore calling me. Sorry. Well,
and you wonder why not?
Yeah. Why should Senator Ortman, I guess the question I have. And it looks like you've spent a lot of time, you know, put a lot of work into this. But it sounds like it's not just codifying practice, but that we're expanding the law or changing the law. Did I misunderstand you in terms of what could be considered for aggravating factors?
Madam Chair, we're not expanding the law at all. We are trying to codify what is current practice in Minnesota so that it doesn't get caught in this gap. This is actually current law as we all sit here and understand it. This Minnesota Supreme Court case, I thought, created more of a confusion and that we were going to go back to where we were prior to that.
Well, okay, Senator Ortman, I guess I don't have an opinion one way or the other on this either because, honestly, this isn't an area I know that much about. But I'm just a little concerned about doing this, having this discussion at this time as an amendment, if we don't have, you know, both sides talking about the implications here, perhaps the defenders and the prosecutors should be weighing in on this, I guess is my only concern. Well, Senator Betzel?
Well, Madam Chair, that was going to be my point. I see, I've looked around, and when we get to this time of night, I look around and say, why are some people still hanging around? And I see a lot of people from the county attorney's side. I don't see Mr. Stewart. And I don't know if the defense side was even aware that this was coming up. Apparently, the county attorneys did. So I'm a bit concerned about taking up an issue without hearing, you know, well, given the opportunity, and because there was no way everybody would have known this was coming up.
Well, Madam Chair and members, there are a couple options here. If it's the will of the committee to put the A3 amendment into the bill, and we could ask for input directly to me, and if there are issues with this language, I will strip it out on the floor when I present the omnibus bill. The other option is that we could leave it out and have people give me input, and if we feel that this language is not problematic, then we can amend it onto the omnibus bill on the floor. But I'm a little bit concerned because I wanted to keep this bill tight. I'm looking to Senator Ortman and Senator Limmer to help us help discipline all of our members so that it doesn't really, I mean, become a problematic issue. I mean, it's just it's just a purely mechanical issue. And at the end of the day, if we don't have an omnibus bill, if I need to, I could strip out everything and just go with my singular 993 language, and I'll still have a chance to go up against, you know, the omnibus bill. But I thought it would be helpful to protect some of our members' language. So, I guess I would look to counsel from the members as to how they want to deal with the A3 amendment. Or we could try to see if we can take testimony to see if it would satisfy the members.
Madam Chair.
Senator
Shine. Madam Chair, a couple points, if I can remember both of them. First of all, I appreciate that Senator Ortman is giving us something that is a counterproposal, if you will. It's a place for the Senate to, you know, have some position. And the other thing is that I think I'd rather see it in the bill and come out than get on the floor and start having everybody parse all the words of the amendment that's offered. So that's just, you know, and I understand, and I know Senator Ortman understands that you may take it out, and I respect that. But that's also a good way to get the input we want.
Well, Senator Ma, if Senator Ortman's okay with that, you know, just understanding that if there's resistance that would lead us to believe we should have had a hearing, a full hearing on the bill, that she's okay with it coming out, then I don't have a problem with that either. Senator Betzel?
Well, Madam Chair, if it's the intention to take testimony, I'd like to know, are we going to hear both sides tonight or just one side? Because if we're only going to hear one side because one side knew it was coming, the other side didn't, I want no part of that.
Yeah. Well, Madam Chair, I guess I would assume that the side... Senator Moore, I guess I would assume that the side that's here to testify is in favor of this, and I think the issue should be, if we hear from the public defenders that they have a problem with it, then we probably should have had a hearing where we heard from both sides together. Senator Ortman?
Well, Madam Chair, I would respectfully say that we did take testimony on this on both sides. We were all here. And so I've done some work to craft what I think is a fair amendment, given what I think both sides would say here. I haven't taken a side. What I did was try to put together what I thought was a broad enough brush to say in this position that we respect the aggravating circumstances that have been used in the law so far, and that we expect that the top of the sentencing guidelines is not the top of it at all times, and that was the distinction. And so in the case that was brought forward, there was someone, and I think that Mr. Brown can testify about this, but someone was sentenced above the sentencing guidelines given some aggravated circumstances, and the Supreme Court said that that was not allowable. And that's exactly what we should be doing, which is to support our sentencing guideline practices that we currently have in place. And that's what I'm asking us to do without taking a county attorney's position and without taking a public defender's position. But again, I would say we did hear testimony on this issue. And this is not – this. I mean, the idea of aggravating factors was not an issue. The idea of having the top of the range was not an issue. And so I've tried to take, as I say, a very broad approach to this issue. And I would hope that we would include this. We can take further input from the public defenders. I'm not afraid of that. I welcome that. I hope that they'll, if they have concerns about this, would bring it to the members of this committee, and we'll deal with it as we go forward.
But, well, Senator Betzel.
Well, Madam Chair, yes, we did take testimony, and we decided to lay the bill over. And as I say, it just baffles me to look around and see county attorneys sitting here. They knew it was coming. Maybe I'm wrong, but they must have known it was coming, and they wouldn't have stayed around there this long. And I just don't see anybody from the other side. So obviously, this is stacked, and I just don't buy it.
Madam Chair,
Senator Ortman,
I have great respect for Senator Betzold, but there was nothing stacked about this, Senator Betzold. This was my amendment. It was no one else's amendment.
Well, Senator Ortman, I think the point that Senator Betzold's making is that this is an issue that we have two sides that probably would have wanted to have something to say about it, and this is a new proposal, different than what we considered before, that we should, if we're going to consider it, give both sides that would have an interest in it an equal opportunity to be heard. And so it would seem to me that we don't really have a chance to come back and hear from the public defender's office if they have problems with this. if it goes into the bill, you know, once we're done with our committee hearings, I mean, we're not going to. So my concern would be if this goes in, that if they raise objections to this, that it'll come out again without your objection. Otherwise, I won't vote to put it in. I mean, I don't know how others feel about it, but.
Well, Madam Chair, as I said, we do amendments all the time here. It's not my job to, and I haven't taken a position, as I've said. I tried to craft what I thought was a fair position for the Senate. I think that it will withstand the public defender's scrutiny. Maybe they're not here because they don't oppose it. I don't know. I don't think that it was made public in advance, but I think they knew that we were talking about our policy bill tonight. They're as informed as anybody. I think this provision can be taken out on the Senate floor, just like any other provision can be taken out on the Senate floor, and we can have a good and hearty and healthy debate about that. I'm sure that they'll all be aware of it after this discussion tonight, and we'll all hear from them. I welcome that.
Senator Moy?
Madam Chair, Mr. Brown is in the audience. Mr. Brown, was there a Court of Appeals decision that was that came down today?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm David Brown. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. To answer your question, Madam Chair, yes, there was. It was a decision that touched on, I know some of the testimony, and I want to be clear about why I'm here to answer questions. I know we had substantive testimony on this bill. Senator Ortman, we had seen this amendment for the first time today, and we were asked to be here to answer questions about it. So I don't mean to testify substantively about one side or the other. This is a completely different amendment. But there was a decision that came down in the Court of Appeals, and what was important about it was two of the aggravating factors that the district court had used to enhance a sentence on a sexual assault of a young woman, interestingly by a woman, done in a particularly brutal way, were thrown out based on the decision that was discussed at that earlier hearing. So the notion that that was a single case, single impact, got driven home today that in fact it was not. This is something that is going to affect us because the court today, the Court of Appeals said they felt bound by the court decision that was issued by the Supreme Court last May. And that's about the time frame you would see those decisions coming out. So.
Thank you.
The answer is yes.
Madam Chair,
Senator
I was not
Ortman.
Aware of the decision. That's the first I've heard of it as well. It's one of the reasons why I would like to keep this alive for now. Let's take additional input from public defenders. I will personally seek them out, ask their review. I make that commitment to you tonight that I'll talk to John Stewart and others and ask them for their input and changes that they might like, see if they're okay with this, and I will report back to the members of the committee before this bill gets heard on the Senate floor. And if I can't find some way to answer questions of this committee and earn your support, then I myself may be forced to take it out. I don't want to lose this battle on the Senate floor. It's too important. This is a very important issue, and I think we can move forward and work through it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzold.
Madam Chair, a question for both Senator Ortman and Mr. Brown and maybe anybody from the County Attorney's Association. If the public defenders object to having this in the bill, are you going to try to keep it in?
It's already in the, a different version is in the House.
I'm in the Senate, Mr. Brown.
I understand that, Senator. And the best way I can answer that to you is, obviously we took a position at the earlier hearing as to this issue. That's really for the members of the committee to decide whether this should stay in or out. I can't take a position. I can tell you the association has a position.
Okay. Madam Chair, then I'm going to oppose it going in the bill because it sounds to me once it goes in the bill, you want it to stay in. Thank you.
Madam Chair. Senator Schein.
Madam Chair, I think, though, that another question to be asked might be, I'm assuming an answer, you'd work with Senator Ortman and others and even the public defender to maybe satisfy some concerns about some of the language. I mean, I'm assuming you would do that. I'm not, that doesn't mean you're going to advocate for no change. It just means you think there should be something. I understand that the association or the organization thinks there should be something in there. And I think it's important that the Senate have some
well-thought-out position, which I think Senator Ortman has presented. So am I correct, Mr. Brown?
As to a willingness to work with all sides, absolutely. And to the extent that anybody feels as though there was unfairness as to who's here, I can't speak to that. And we want there to be input from both sides. I think they play a vital role in making sure we have good laws passed. Sometimes I don't agree with it, but having the discussion is important. So in terms of a willingness to work with both sides, of course. And I just want to thank Senator Ortman for bringing the issue back. She's offered something that I don't think either side or any of the parties had. It wasn't any side's idea, as I understand it. This was Senator Ortman.
Well, sir, with all due respect, and Senator Ortman, I just have to say that it seems to me that it's hard to have a well-thought-out position if we haven't had the opportunity for full discussion and hearing from both sides. And so, you know, on something as important as this, when we have a Supreme Court case, now a Court of Appeals case, and we would be reversing those decisions essentially by adopting this language, that we should be fully vetting that decision, not just accepting something and then waiting to see if there's a reaction even, but having that full discussion so we could have a well-thought-out opinion. I don't know that I agree or disagree with this opinion, Senator Ortman, but I do sort of disagree with the way it's being presented, and especially without the public defenders being here. It seems to me that they should have at least been given notice and an opportunity to be here.
Madam Chair, so in fairness to Senator Ortman, I will take full responsibility for that. I knew Senator Ortman had indicated to me of her intention to do this amendment this afternoon, and it was just a mistake on my part not to put the notice in the agenda to say that, you know, some form of language from this Senate file is going to be considered for inclusion in the omnibus bill. So I take full responsibility for not putting that notice out there. That being said, I mentioned that it would be the will of the committee and whether or not this goes in, and my sense is that there's a discomfort with the way that we've process this without giving maybe full notice for the public, other people who would like to give input. So I think that if Senator Ortman would be willing to withdraw her motion, we ought to consider whether or not there will be an opportunity for us to hear late bills. I'm not sure if there's anything else left. There's nothing else left on my agenda, but this as kind of a hanging out there. And if indeed there are, you know, other bills that are requiring that we come back and we have to do a late hearing, I make a commitment that I will put my bill back on the agenda so that we can have an opportunity to consider Senator Ortman's amendment.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the graciousness of Senator Moi, but I'm not sure we can resolve all of the concerns. I'm not sure, Senator Betzold, the public defenders would ever agree to this if they're winning in the court. But that's why I've taken the position back, rolled it back, and I would think that it's not all that controversial for us to say that we support what's in our sentencing guidelines. I mean, I haven't asked us to do more than that, than to say these are the aggravating factors in our sentencing guidelines, and we support that, and we support the theory that there can be an upward departure from our sentencing guidelines. That's current law. I don't think that that's a surprising position for the Senate to take. I don't think that it's a difficult one to take, and I do think we should have a position that when it comes to these conference committees, we don't want to have just the defenders handwritten. I mean, that was their version. The one that Senator Moi introduced was the language written by the county attorneys. Madam Chair, I rejected that language to try and be more fair and to try and dial us back from the place of it being so in your face to being a restatement of the sentencing guidelines and our current practices that, yes, you can have an upward durational departure.
Senator Ortman, if this is current law, then how can, I mean, we have two cases now that we would be changing the law from what was said in those two cases. So what those two cases said would be current law, and this would be a change from that.
Madam
Chair.
And again,
Senator Ortman, I'm not necessarily disagreeing with your position here. I just feel that it should be fully vetted and we should hear from both sides, because it seems like it would be a change of law from those two recent decisions.
Well, Madam Chair, I would say respectfully it's not. It's a disagreement with the Supreme Court and trying to clarify the misunderstanding that they had. They had a misunderstanding between the dissent and the majority about what we intended. And because they have a misunderstanding about what we intend with our sentencing guidelines, I think it's perfectly appropriate. I think it's necessary. I think in some ways it might be neglectful of our duty not to, when we know that there is a clear misunderstanding in the Supreme Court. We are an equal branch. And I think this is exact. I mean, I can't think of a bill that is more needed than this. It is our job. And I think we have clearly an identified gap that we should be addressing. And I'd hate to see us not do that. I'd hope that we would include it in this bill. I hope that you will support this. I will work with the public defenders to make sure they're aware of it and that we all learn of any concerns that they might have of this.
Well, I guess Senator Moi has suggested something. It sounds like you're rejecting that, so it sounds like what you're doing is moving.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman would like us to take action on the A3 amendment. I think that you should move to do that if she's not willing to withdraw the amendment. But I, you know, we've spent the last, I know, 30 minutes talking about the process when we could have processed the amendment. So, but I do think that input is important, and regardless of what happened, my full expectation is that there will be input and participation. So,
Madam Chair, one final word is that we did have a hearing on this bill. It was noticed. Everybody knew that we were taking up this issue. When we decided that we didn't have the information we needed at that time, which was a Saturday afternoon, all of that, that we would lay it aside. And we laid it aside, and I picked it up to do the work because I thought it was important, and I can't tell you how important I think it is. And that by reading the decision, I find it to be even more important. And so what I'd like to do is ask you to include it. I'll make sure you all see the decision of the Supreme Court and have a chance to judge for yourselves. But this is the Judiciary Committee, and this is where we make these kinds of decisions, and this is a policy bill. We won't have another chance to have a Judiciary Committee position on this other than tonight. And so I hope that the members will support that and trust that I will continue to work with the defenders, make sure they're fully aware of it, and have a chance to air any concerns or suggestions that they might have for us.
Senator Ortman has moved the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
Oh.
Chair is in doubt. All those in favor say raise your hand, please. Opposed? Motion does not prevail.
And Madam Chair, that is Senate File 993. So, Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 993 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
So, members, this brings the work of this legislative session for our policy committee to an end. I want to thank all of you for hanging in there. We've had some really long days, but I really appreciate the great work that you've all done. You have all given me a reputation because of all of your behavior in this committee, and I greatly appreciate it. I also want to extend our deep appreciation to Mr. Backus and Ms. Pontius and Mr. Turner, as well as all the great staff people who've stayed late with us every night and weekends to come and draft our amendments. And then finally, I want to thank Mr. Eric Dick, Mr. James Chang, and Mr. Matt Tuburin, and all the members of the public who have been hanging there with us. You know, we may have been perhaps unpleasant at times, but you all understand that when we're tight, we can't be as courteous as we could be, and so thank you very much for bearing with us. And thank you all very much, and the committee is adjourned.